funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Human beings are products of the natural processes of biology, including evolution. And yet, it's hard to deny that we feel different, don't we? We see ourselves as special in a way that feels bigger than the whims of mutation and the serendipities of natural selection. And as my guest will explain, that feeling, although it's easy to relate to, has caused more than its fair share of delays in the advancement of our understanding about how and from what ancestors we evolved. Ian Tattersall is curator emeritus in the Division of Anthropology of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. His new book is called The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack and Other Cautionary Tales from Human Evolution. Ian, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
You say that in some respects, paleoanthropology has remained static compared to other areas of paleontology. What do you mean by that, and why does it concern you, even at the end of your career?
Well, looking back over the 40, 45 years that I've been in the field, I think there is still a recognizably 1950s air to much of what we believe in paleoanthropology, whereas most other areas of paleontology have absolutely revolutionized in that time. And I think that's because of the lingering influence of one man, Ernst Mayr, about whom I'm sure we'll talk more later.
The idea, and we will talk more in detail, but many people simply wanted to believe that human evolution had moved in sort of a straight line of, like, biological upgrades over time.
That's correct. The fact that there is only one species of human in the world today seems to make it rather natural to reconstruct the past, the history of the species, by projecting it back in time, in a straight line. And that has always been, I think, the tendency. It's been what we've wanted to do. We've taken ourselves and tried to determine our ancestry. And we've portrayed this as sort of a story of a lone hero battling its way against circumstances to ever greater pitches of perfection. And that, it turns out, is absolutely not what happened in the story of human evolution after all. And the fact that we are the lone hominid member of our family in the world today is actually the exception, and it's that that's throwing us off.
All right, let's talk about the rickety Cossack of your title. In the mid-19th mm-hmm. century, there was this discovery of a hominid skeleton. What would have made it instantly identifiable as something different from the remains of Homo sapiens, which is what we are?
Yeah. This discovery of a partial skeleton of an obvious, very ancient relative of human beings was made in Germany originally in 1856. And that was 3 years before Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species, and people were not thinking in an evolutionary context when they first had to confront this new phenomenon. The scientists who initially studied the skeleton that had been found did not have a really solid context in which to place it. They saw that the skull of this creature, which was unfortunately missing the face, was large, that it would have held a brain as large as the brain of a modern person. But on the other hand, it was very thick-boned, and it was long and low, unlike our high-arched skull. And there were these very distinctive brow ridges arching above each eye. And the bones themselves were very robust and clunky with big articular ends. So this was not a typical modern human being by any means. But the temptation was to try to see this as a variation on what people knew, and all people knew at the time was Homo sapiens.
And so we thought, or the thinking was, it sounds sort of bizarre to us now, that this was some a Homo sapiens individual who had some serious medical and social problems.
Well, that's right. That's right. The thing was that the assumption had to be in the earliest discussion of this strange fossil that this was some kind of Homo sapiens that had to be explained. And there's one possibility was that it belonged to some ancient barbarous race of humankind that had existed in the past and was now no longer in existence. And the alternative was pathology, that this was the skeleton of a normal person that had been altered then by disease or by some other process to look rather differently from the way it had looked previously. And so these two possibilities bracketed the possibilities. And some people plumped for the barbarous, ancient barbarous race, and some people tried to elaborate on, you know, what actually was wrong pathologically with this skull. And one notion was that the leg bones looked as if the legs had been bowed a little bit, rather as happens to people who habitually rode horses. And the skull had this sort of low forehead with these big eyebrow ridges in the front of it. And one notion was that this had been a horseman who'd been injured in some way and or who had a pathological affliction. In this case, one suggestion was rickets, and that this condition of rickets had furrowed it, had caused so much pain that the brow of this individual was permanently furrowed, and that had caused the growth of brow ridges at the front of the skull. So, in the ultimate, you know, fantastic interpretation was that this was the remains of a Cossack horseman who had ridden across France in great pain in the campaign of 1814 as the Russians invaded back into France at the end of the Napoleonic invasion, and that somehow this individual had contrived to crawl in a cave and die and be covered by sediments and be dug up by lime workers half a century later.
That is not a satisfying explanation, Ian. But it was better than trying to rethink all of what we understood the nature of human existence to be.
Yeah. Well, you know, we think it's rather crazy today, but you've got to remember that these people who are trying to understand this strange phenomenon were really, really working in a vacuum. They had no context in which to place it. And, you know, I have to say there was a lot of academic infighting at all at the University of Bonn where this fossil was first described. And, you know, faculty members felt they had to come up with better explanations than their colleagues to look good in this whole thing.
I hadn't really thought about this because today when we talk about evolution, we think so much about the fossil record. But Darwin himself was not really so interested in fossils and developing his ideas. He was working with living specimens whose adaptations he felt like he could observe really in the wild.
That's correct. Darwin was always a little bit suspicious of the fossil record for some reason. And he was particularly suspicious of the human fossil record. In fact, he didn't really want to discuss this at all. In 1864, which was 3 years after the after The Origin of Species had been published, and therefore the idea of evolution was in the air, another discovery was brought to London of a skull that would have been similar, of a similar kind to the Neanderthal specimen that was discovered in Gibraltar. And this was brought to London in 1864. And we have a letter that Darwin wrote to a colleague telling his friend that another colleague had brought this skull to him. And this is a skull actually with a face. It looks in most comparable features rather like the Neanderthal, very much the same kind of thing, but it's more complete. And you can just imagine Darwin holding this thing in his hands and turning it around and looking at it, and you can only imagine what was going on in the skull of this brilliant man. This was a man with one of the most inquiring minds ever. And he must have held it and looked at it from all angles. And we cannot but guess. We can only guess what was going on in his head, because he never said another word about it. Not even when he wrote a huge two-volume work called The Descent of Man that was published in 1871. He never said a word about this, and yet we know he held it in his hands. I wish I knew what he was thinking.
When did people start asking the question, why is it that there is one species of human, at least, you know, extant today, and there are so many other species of just about every other organism we know of?
That is an extremely good question. And basically, I think we have always tended to think that we are the product of a slow process of improvement over time, because we are alone in the world. You know, most other members of successful mammalian genera, as ours is, the genus Homo is very successful. It has many species, all of which are extinct except for Homo sapiens now. Normally, they have several different relatives belonging to the same genus out there in the world, and we don't. And I think that tells us something very special about ourselves. But I think the assumption has always been that we are alone in the world and therefore need to be understood in our own particular terms, rather than in terms that you usually try to apply to successful genera, which is to explain diversity. We have no diversity to explain, or only a very minor level of diversity to explain, unlike all the other very successful mammalian genera out there.
How much does any surviving species owe to just serendipitous timing of adaptive mutations?
Well, I think everything owes a lot to history, and we have to remember that in our own history, we think that there was a point at which we became human. I mean, it's natural to think there is a particularly a cognitive gap between us and anything else alive in the world, and we think there was a moment when we became human, and in a sense there was, but in fact, we are constructed on a whole series of innovations that go all the way back to the very earliest vertebrates 400 million years ago. And if any of those innovations hadn't occurred, things would be very, very different today. So history is supremely important in the appearance and in the survival of any organism.
Ian Tattersall is my guest. He's curator emeritus in the Division of Anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. His new book is called The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack and Other Cautionary Tales from Human Evolution. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies Program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Curator Emeritus in the Division of Anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, Ian Tattersall. His new book is called The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack and Other Cautionary Tales from Human Evolution. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You can also find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. So, Ian, it's one thing to have one or even a couple of these Neanderthal skeletons showing up. What happened as people began to discover more and more physical evidence that something different from modern humans had existed that couldn't quite square with the way we understood our own development over time?
When the earliest human fossils after the first two were pretty much all Neanderthals, because Neanderthals lived in Europe and it was Europeans who were looking for them. And so evidence steadily grew up or accumulated that the Neanderthal morphology, the Neanderthal anatomy, was a real thing biologically and something that had to be come to terms with, and that an ancient species that was like us but not quite like us had to be basically accepted. And once that acceptance was made, the way was open for further discoveries. And the interesting thing was that after Darwin, the job of interpreting human fossils as they were discovered fell really not to evolutionary biologists like Darwin was, but to human anatomists. And human anatomists came out of a tradition where they were really, really fixated and focused on very small variations in the anatomy of human beings. Every individual differs from every other individual, and they were busy documenting this kind of variation. And these were the people into whose hands the archaeologists who dug up the fossils gave them for analysis. And these guys really weren't very much concerned with the wider world beyond Homo sapiens. It was this sort of laser-like focus on our own species, but not much concern with the position of humans in the diversity of the greater living world. And so there was really rather a special kind of a thing. A kind of a perspective that developed in paleoanthropology. And these guys also weren't taxonomists. They were not systematists. They were not people who were used to sort of classifying the great variety of organisms that were out there. And so they tended to use zoological names pretty much as sort of of denominators of individual fossils. They would give them a genus and a species name, much as, you know, you have yourself, your family name, and your given name. And so a huge number of names accumulated in the human fossil record, giving the inaccurate impression that there were many, many, many varieties of extinct humans out there. And that all continued right through the period of the Second World War. And by the time the World War came along, there were 15 genera of extinct hominids, and God knows how many species.
So then you have this guy, Ernst Mayr, come along. And tell us about him and how a guy who studied birds ended up having such a huge effect on the work that you and your colleagues do.
Yeah. Yeah, Ernst Mayr was a very interesting and very forceful character. He was a curator at my own museum, the American Museum of Natural History, and he was a curator of ornithology. And he was famous not only for doing a lot of field work in places like New Guinea and studying the lives of the specimens that he collected, but he also was one of the founders of what became known as the evolutionary synthesis, which was basically a convergence of genetics and of paleontology and of systematics, the study of diversity in the world, bringing it all together in one single coherent account of evolutionary process. And what the synthesis, formulated was that evolution basically boiled down to a gradual change among lineages of organisms under the tutelage of natural selection. It made it a slow, gradual process that took lots and lots of time to accumulate. And Ernst Mayr was a high priest, or one of the high priests, as it were, or one of the great advocates of this new view of the evolutionary process.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Scott in Fort Worth. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Chris. Love the show.
Thanks.
I have a question for your guest, the doctor. We talked about how we are special, at least looking even at early humans. There could be a possibility, a range of diversity in family members of our species and the number of species that we have. Is it possible that one of the things that make us human and unique is our willingness to be violent against similar but strikingly different species early on? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, well, you're clearly an observer of the way our species functions. And yeah, it is very, very tempting to look upon our own particular sophisticated ways of applying violence as being responsible for our success. And in a way, that's true. But I think there's something underlying that. We are able to target violence. We are able to use violence in the ways that we do because we have this ability to reimagine the world in our minds. We have what they call symbolic thought, symbolic cognition, which allows us to wield violence as a tool in a particularly sophisticated and effective way. And underlying this ability is actually the cognitive difference that marks us off from every other organism.
It's certainly fascinating to think of a moment in history where different species of humans might have coexisted and, in fact, even interacted. Mm-hmm. And it appears that it wasn't just Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, that there may have been other species that were sort of together in the same regions as recently as, what, about 2 million years ago?
Well, as recently as maybe 40,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago. That's absolutely right. Just to give you a bit of background, Ernst Mayr was not convinced of this at all. Ernst Mayr believed that the possession of material culture broadened the human ecological niche so much that only one kind of human could live in the world at any one time. And that's not just going for Homo sapiens, but any time in the human past as well. So he, in 1950, got up and told the paleoanthropologists who had all these names, you know, floating around in the literature, he told them in no uncertain terms that they had, that there was only three species of hominid members of the human family in the entire human fossil record, and that those species occurred in a succession. One species giving rise to another to another. He said, well, we start off with Homo transvalensis, which is what today we call the Australopiths, the early bipeds. Then that gave rise gradually, transformed gradually into a form called Homo erectus, which in turn transformed into Homo sapiens, in which Mayr would include the Neanderthals. And this became received wisdom in paleoanthropology. And this was basically the mindset that conditioned paleoanthropology throughout most of the latter half of the 20th century. But all the time, during the second half of the 20th century, fossil discoveries were being made. They were being made in South Africa. They were being made in East Africa. They were being made in Java. They were being made in Europe. They were being made all over the place. And by 1993, I recall, I was able to draw up a family tree of humans with 12 different species in it, 12 different species everybody could agree upon. And 20 years later, in this the descendant of this diagram, there were 24 species. And these were just forced, really, upon paleoanthropology by the sheer pressure of discovery and having to do something to classify these new fossils that were coming in. And what these diagrams showed, both of them in 1993 and in 2012, was that typically several different kinds of hominids had existed in the world at the same time, and sometimes on the same landscape. So that diversity of hominids was pretty much as you would have expected to find in any successful family of mammals. And that underlines how being alone in the world as we are today is really unusual. And it's unusual not just for an organism in general, it's unusual for a hominid.
It's certainly a lot of change to accept within the course of, 20 years over a career. Is there something about the field of paleoanthropology that made it a little harder than it would be elsewhere to accept big changes that overturned traditional thinking in something like astronomy or physics?
Well, yeah, that is a very, very good observation. And I think there was. There was, first of all, the lingering influence of Ernst Mayr and his linear arrangement of species. Mayr had a tremendous amount of authority as being a practicing systematist who worked on birds and being one of the fathers of this new synthesis of evolution. And beyond that, we still had the end result, which was just one species. And there was always that temptation to project that one species back into time, which is, how we started. And it's been very difficult to get beyond that.
It's also, of course, easy to assume that because we are the one species that survived into the modern era, that we must somehow be better, like that it was preordained mm-hmm. that this would be the line that would take over the world. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence that that's true, or could, some kind of advanced human civilization have come from one of the other human species that has gone extinct?
Oh, that's another very, very good question to raise. I don't think that we can use words like preordained or inevitable at all. We're tempted because we're dealing from the situation that we know exists. But as I said before, if any of a lot of different things had not happened in the past, things would not be the same today. We are not the only hominid to have gotten a big brain. I think the fact that we're alone in the world has a lot to do with the way we process information in our minds. And the way we process information is dependent, evidently, on having a large brain of the kind that we have. But we're not the only hominid to have obtained a large brain over time. There's a form called Homo erectus over there in Java that has a fossil record way back from more than 1.5 million years ago, right to about 40,000 years ago. And it seems to have showed a trend towards increasing brain size with time. We have the Neanderthals, who had a brain as big as we did and had independently acquired that big brain from a smaller-brained ancestor. And, of course, we have our own lineage, which is also derived from a smaller-brained ancestor. So there is this tendency in the hominid, in the genus Homo, to having a larger brain. And until we understand what that tendency is based on, we're not really going to fully understand what it was that made us ourselves. But it's not clear right now exactly what that ingredient was. But theoretically, any of these large-brained lineages could, I suppose, have produced a form that reasons as we do but it just happens to have happened in our own. And we don't have any evidence, really, that the kind of complex reasoning that we exhibit today actually ever arose in any other lineage, no matter how big its brain.
It is fascinating to think about if we hadn't been the victors here, if you want to call it that, because there's not evidence necessarily of direct competition, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating to think what culture would have looked like if it had been some other species.
Well, you know, it's fascinating for us to imagine what culture will look like. This is one of the great imponderables. I don't think that under the present demographic circumstances, with human beings packed cheek by jowl across the world, that there really is much possibility of humans changing biologically and meaningfully changing anytime in the future, as long as present demographic circumstances persist. But as far as culture is concerned, all bets are off. We are now in this era of astonishing change. You know, we're living in a different world from the one our parents lived in, and they lived in a different world from the one their own parents lived in. We're in this incredible age of cultural ferment, and nobody knows where it's going to lead. We know that relatively simple cultures were what dominated the lives of our predecessors, but we have all bets are off in terms of what our descendants will experience culturally.
We're speaking this hour with Ian Tattersall. He is Curator Emeritus in the Division of Anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. His new book is called The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack and Other Cautionary Tales from Human Evolution. You can be part of this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ian Tattersall, Curator Emeritus in the Division of Anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History. His new book is called The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack and Other Cautionary Tales from Human Evolution. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Peter on the line in Dallas. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, you know, I can't help but notice that I'm a heavy-boned individual, and I've got a big, a heavy brow over my eyes, and I'm just wondering how much of me is Neanderthal.
That's a very good question. Probably not very much of you is Neanderthal. We are, as a species, quite remarkable among hominids for being fairly light-boned, and even you are going to... If you look at the bones of some of our hominid ancestors and you compare them to X-rays of your own, you're going to find that you're relatively small-boned compared to some of them. But some of us are fairly well muscled and fairly heavy-boned. And some of us do have eyebrow ridges on above our eyes, but they're not like Neanderthal eyebrow ridges. They are actually you can feel yourself if you can feel there's a sort of a diagonal division in your eyebrow ridge above your eye, right there in the center, which is very diagnostic of Homo sapiens and doesn't occur in Neanderthals. There are some DNA studies now which suggests that there was a little bit of interbreeding between Neanderthals who were resident in Europe and modern humans expanding out of Africa and into Europe and across into Asia in the period around 60, 50, 40,000 years ago. And it would be surprising if there wasn't a bit of that. But in fact, this intermixing seems to have been rather small in scale and didn't really affect the future trajectory of either species, either Homo sapiens or Homo neanderthalensis, as a distinctive biological entity. So yeah, it's quite possible if you are a European that you have a few Neanderthal genes, much less likely if you were of African ancestry. You may have the odd Neanderthal gene, but it won't make a lot of difference to the kind of creature that you are.
I did one of those tests once, and I think I had like 3 or 4% Neanderthal. And I'm wondering how much we can learn about these cousins we have on the evolutionary chart by looking at DNA and how useful that is when these samples are so very old. How much is preserved?
Not a lot. The thing about DNA is that it's a very fragile molecule, and it degrades over time. It's a very long molecule that basically comes apart into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. But it just so happens that with the next generation high throughput DNA sequencing techniques, what you do is to actually sequence very, very small pieces of DNA. And you use enzymes to snip modern DNA up, but actually nature's done it for you in the case of Neanderthals. So high throughput sequencing is actually a technique that's very well adapted to studying ancient DNA. But when you get back beyond about 40,000 years, the DNA gets to be very difficult to deal with, and there has been a report now of a partial mitochondrial genome from a fossil that is some 430,000 years old or thereabouts. But that's about as far back as it goes, and that's a very partial part of the genome.
Ian, are our brains special strictly because of biology, or is there something about the way that we use them that has made us different, functionally different than we were 20,000 years ago?
Oh, that's such a good question. Because the very earliest Homo sapiens, who arose in Africa about 200,000 years ago, just about the same time as the Neanderthal species was coming into existence in Europe, these guys presumably had the same brain that we did. They had the same cognitive potential we did, but they do not appear to have significantly or behaved significantly differently from Neanderthals, for example. They don't appear to have had the very specific form of symbolic cognition that we have. And The new uses for the brain to produce symbolic cognition had to be invented. It had to be discovered. This new potential, you know, had to be released by some kind of a cultural factor, which, in my view, was probably the invention of language. So you can have a brain structured basically the way ours is, but not producing the same kind of cognition. And, you know, that's not very surprising because in evolution, everything has to be back compatible. And genetic novelties often hang around for long, long periods of time if they don't get in the way before they're co-opted for a new use. Think of the feathers of birds, for example. The ancestors of birds had feathers for millions of years before they started using them to fly, which then became their hallmark of birds, and the modern human brain is apparently a similar kind of a case.
What accounts for the fact that we have brains that can be very logical, we can be very cooperative, but we don't always behave in these ways, even when it would seem as if they are to the advantage of typically us as individuals and also the species?
Yeah, that's a great observation. And I think it basically is as a result of the adventitious nature of our brains. It's clear that we acquired both our modern morphology, the modern brain morphology, and the modern brain function in short-term events. These were acquired in short-term events. They were not fine-tuned over long, long periods of time by natural selection. The idea that you know we are the outcome of one single unwavering lineage that was modified over time would suggest that, in fact, nature had shaped us for some kind of a purpose, that we had in some way been optimized by natural selection over a long period of time to be the kind of creatures that we are. And that would be kind of deterministic. It would mean that we were kind of in a biological envelope from which we might have difficulty escaping. But when you look upon the origin of modern humans as a relatively small, recent, short-term, and emergent kind of event, you can see that we weren't perfected or shaped or molded by natural selection for particular purposes. And we have these extraordinary capacities. But we are a glorious sort of mishmash of new and primitive brain functions. And that's what makes us such contradictory creatures.
So rather than thinking of the processes of evolution as something that like absolutely sculpts and perfects everything for a perfect purpose, it's more like it sort of duct tapes things together so that they work well enough. Is that right?
That is exactly right. Yeah. Evolution for the most point is for most part is about being good enough to get by under whatever the prevailing circumstances happen to be. It's not about optimization. We're not creatures that were designed by an engineer. An engineer would say, okay, we need a certain function. Let's get the best structure that we can to provide this function. And we are clearly not engineered in that way. And this is a very good thing because it's what gives us our free will.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to indulge me here, and I won't be able to see you roll your eyes if that's what you're doing right now. But imagine that in a lab you could meet living, surviving members. You could meet, you know, Homo floresiensis and Homo erectus and Homo heidelbergensis. What would you want to observe in them? What kind of tests would you want to conduct? What are the things that you would be most curious about in being able to meet a living member of one of these species?
Well, you know, I'd rather meet them in their natural habitat than in the lab. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I had a time machine, I would have great difficulty in deciding exactly which point in human evolution I'd like to go back in and observe. But I would be looking for really for this key thing of how they manipulate information about the world around them. We know that many of these predecessors were very accomplished at making tools. They had very complex lives in many ways. And what I'd like to know is the point at which they started showing the particular imagination that modern human beings have, the ability to deconstruct the world in their minds into a vocabulary of mental symbols that they can then rearrange as we do to come up with new hypotheses about the world, with new alternatives and new possibilities. That is the key of our success, and it's the key to our uniqueness, this ability to remake the world in our minds. And I would really dearly love to see the moment at which this first happened in any hominid.
How far back does it appear the capacity for language goes? Did that start with us?
I believe it did. I think that the transition to to symbolic thought, probably stimulated by the invention of language, happened within the tenure on Earth of Homo sapiens as a recognizable anatomical entity. You know, as I think I've already mentioned, Homo sapiens appears at around 200,000 years ago. But it's not until about 100,000 years ago that it starts showing evidence in its archaeological record that it left behind it of the new way of manipulating symbols and of living in the world as it was recreated in the mind and not just as it was presented to them by nature.
And is there, I mean, how important is culture? Could I, if I had that time machine that you referred to, could I adopt a baby from 20,000 years ago at birth and bring it into my home and raise it and send it to college?
From 20,000 years ago, I think certainly. From 100,000 years ago, I'd say almost certainly. From 200,000 years ago, I'd have to say probably. And it is difficult. It is really difficult to know. But clearly, our own ancestors, spontaneously invented this new way of thinking, this ability to absorb the kind of culture that we take for granted today. Clearly, this was invented at some point by hominids. And it has to be. I think it's clearly that point came after hominids who looked just like us had been in the world already for about 100,000 years. They had a capacity, and they had to wait a while before they discovered how to use it.
I'm going to steal this last question from your epilogue. Why does it matter how we evolved?
I think it matters for a number of ways. If we think of ourselves as being the outcome of this slow, steady Homo transvalensis to Homo erectus to Homo sapiens progression over time, we really have to look upon ourselves as a perfected product or a product that has been molded by evolution in some way, and. If we look upon ourselves as the adventitious result of a process of evolutionary experimentation whereby different kinds of hominid, new species of hominid, were produced and thrown out into the natural world to compete and to survive or to fail, we're much more accidental creatures. And being accidental would explain much more about what we observe about ourselves than this notion that we were gradually perfected over the eons.
Ian Tattersall's new book is The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack and Other Cautionary Tales from Human Evolution. Ian, it's been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you for making this time for us.
It's been fun. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.